Dennis, thank you very much. I apologise once again for not being here yesterday. So, in terms of the constitutional consequences for the EU of what we're seeing, what I'm going to do is divide these into two, but I'm really going to focus on the second part for reasons which will become apparent. So, there's at least two ways in which you can think about the constitutional consequences of what's going on in for the EU. The first way, and the one I'm not going to spend much time on, partly because it's too scary, is that there's simply no doubt that if we ended up, or if we do end up, with an EU where a significant number of national governments of the member states are run by right-wing populist parties. So if in a post-Renzi Italy we ended up with Griot, if in Holland we ended up with Wilders, if in France we ended up with Le Pen, and if, heaven forbid, Merkel got pushed over the cliff and we ended up with the alt-right movement in Germany, then, I mean, the constitutional consequences for the EU are unimaginable. I mean, the EU ceases, you know, I think I'm a very simple person, and basically, if we have that scenario, then the EU means something different from what it has meant up until now, and this simply think that there's no way around it. The interpretation of the values in Articles 1 and 2 of the TEU would take on a completely different meaning, and I'm not sure, or I think it's a real question about whether the EU could really continue to subsist if it had a significant number of right-wing populist parties, not just because they're right-wing and populist, but because, and therefore, not just because they don't take the values or give a very different read to the values in Articles 1 and 2 to the reading or interpretation of those values accorded by more traditional liberal Western governments. It's not just that, but because their whole attitude towards the idea of centralized power or giving some degree of sovereignty over to a central authority is so very different from that which has been the norm for the last 40, 50 years. And so one constitutional consequence, the nuclear nightmare, I think, constitutional consequence, would be that you get enough of these parties in power and it destabilizes and places in jeopardy the whole European project as we have known it for the reasons that I've just mentioned. Okay, and I'm very happy to talk about that and also discuss that in more detail, but I want to focus on the other dimension now, which is that, and the other dimension is, what should the EU's response be at present to countries that pose a rule of law problem, broadly conceived, for the EU? What should the EU's response be in those circumstances? And on this, there's been a very considerable amount of literature for those who are familiar with this area. But it is a very interesting issue in all sorts of ways and for all sorts of reasons. And the more particular frame that I want to use in considering this second dimension is that I want to break this issue down into three more particular parts. Because really what's at stake is when you investigate the second question, what's at stake is an issue of regulation, the extent to which the EU should exercise some kind of regulatory control over the relevant regimes that are posing rule of law problems for the EU. And the three more particular issue subparts that that issues that that poses can be, I think, articulated in the following way. And this is simply taking a very simple model, which I think is applicable to any kind of regulation, but it's equally applicable here. The three sub-questions are whether the EU should regulate, who should regulate, and how it should regulate. These are just three fundamental, straightforward questions that apply whenever anyone seeks to regulate anything. Whether you should do it, whether, stroke, why you should do it, how you should do it, who should do it, how you should do it. So I'm going to say a little bit about, within the confines of the available time, I just want to say a little bit about each of these. So, whether they should regulate, whether and why they should, the EU should regulate. Well, to some extent, the issue is straightforward, and to some extent it is not. It is straightforward in the sense that the EU has a firm, solid treaty foundation for regulatory oversight contained in Article 7 of the Treaty of European Union. And the Treaty of European Union was designed, Article 7 was designed, initially this provision was put in because of the Austrian problem back in, I think it was the late 1990s, and fears of what might be happening in Austria at that time. And so basically what Article 7 does, as updated, is that it gives the EU some basis for regulatory oversight when it becomes clear that one of the member states is acting such as to pose a risk of a breach, of a serious breach, of the values in Article 2 of the TEU. So Article 1 and 2 set out the core values. So the idea, the core idea of Article 7 is if there's evidence that a state is posing a risk, a clear risk of a serious breach of Article 7, then the machinery in Article 7 kicks into being. Now, Article 7 is there in the background. Since the current malaise of problems in the EU, which is problems in particular with Hungary, Poland, Romania, etc., I think the starting point of modern discussion, as it were, is the 2014 Commission paper, in which the Commission set out a new framework to strengthen the rule of law. And it articulated, and we're focusing just still for the moment on whether and why you should regulate. So the Commission articulated reasons why it was devising the paper it was devising and why it thought that the EU should have some regulatory role in this area. And it listed three reasons why it thought that the EU should be involved. Firstly, that compliance with the rule of law was a prerequisite for the protection of all fundamental values listed in Article 2 of the TEU, respect for human dignity, freedom, democracy, equality, and human rights. Secondly, that compliance with the rule of law was also a prerequisite more generally for upholding all rights and obligations derived from the treaties and from international law. And thirdly, and a bit more specifically, but still importantly, compliance with the rule of law was required in order to ensure the mutual trust on which what is known in the jargon of the trade as the area of freedom, security and justice within the EU was grounded. That if you didn't have the rule of law, so the basic idea here was that if one country couldn't trust the courts of another country to give you a fair deal and an objective deal, then the whole foundation for the AFSJ regime, which is based on mutual recognition, starts crumbling away. Okay. So, important as well, so that was the reason why the Commission thought it should be involved. Important as well to understand that when the Commission thinks about the rule of law, it adopts a particular vision of the rule of law. We all know, or everyone around this table would be fully aware of the different meanings of the rule of law which are out there in the literature, formal, substantive, quasi-substantive, etc., etc. I'm not getting into that debate now. Suffice it to say for the present that the Commission adopts a pretty thoroughgoing, substantive conception of the rule of law. It's not simply a Razzian conception. It's a conception which fully endorses the idea that fundamental rights, human rights, are an integral part of the rule of law, etc. So too are a number of other. Substantive dimensions. Now, the essence of the Commission. So you might think, well, okay, this is all fine, but we've got Article 7, so what was the Commission's paper proposing? What were we putting on the table in addition to Article 7? Well, in effect, what the Commission was proposing in terms of its regulatory initiative, what it was proposing was a form of investigation which in effect took place before Article 7 got triggered. It was the invention, the creation of a preliminary mode of inquiry by the Commission about rule of law violations in a particular state, which was based upon the idea of detailed investigation by the Commission, dialogue with the state, the possibility of the state responding to Commission problems, and then the Commission reflecting on all of this. And then the idea was that if the state had not satisfied the Commission, then Article 7 would be triggered at that stage. So we were creating something which didn't exist within the framework of the treaties themselves. We are creating a new process, a new procedure, ex ante, before you got to Article 7. So three-stage process, assessment, recommendation, follow-up. Okay, so that is, in brief terms, the Commission's rationale for whether and why the EU should be involved in regulation in this area. Before I pass on to who should do the regulation, let me, however, just add one extra dimension here about whether the EU should regulate, because it is, I think, important, and it's a sort of elephant in the room, if it's not put on the table, as it were, insofar as you can put an elephant on the table, mixing my metaphors, as it were. So the point is this, and it's relevant to this area, but it's also, it has a more general relevance, and it's this. One of the endemic problems with the EU throughout its whole history is that it has been given tasks to perform, and it hasn't always been given the powers to perform the tasks which people expect of it. Most obvious and painful example of that recently is in relation to the financial crisis. The regime for economic and monetary union was predicated on having an economic and monetary union in which the EU was given very significant powers over monetary union, central bank, euro, etc., and had very, very, very limited powers over economic union, fiscal deficits in member states, etc. And indeed, one reading of that whole story is of the financial crisis is that the EU has been playing catch-up since 2009-10 and developing extra controls at the EU level to control economic union budgets, fiscal deficits, etc. Because they've realised that they have to have that power. Well, to some extent, you've got the same malaise here in the following sense. The bit about whether the EU should regulate and why it should regulate still is not telling the whole story in this sense. It's partly, and what's missing is this really, that part of the reason why the EU feels that it should regulate is to some extent it feels responsible for the malaise in the state. Now that's not a priori causal logic, it's nothing of the kind. But the idea of why it feels responsible is nonetheless readily understandable. And it feels responsible because the way things work in the EU, before a state becomes a member of the EU, it has to go through what are known as the Copenhagen criteria. And under the Copenhagen criteria, you test the state for a whole series of things, including respect for the values in Article 2 of the TEU. And that's usually done pretty rigorously. So the idea is, well, you know, the outside world looks in and say, well, you cleared these countries to get into the EU. They're now a member of the club. You bear some responsibility for the fact that they're now going off the rails, insofar as they're going off the rails. Now, of course, it's not the EU doesn't have control in depth over the kind of problems that we're seeing in Poland or Hungary or existed in Romania. But nonetheless, the very fact is that these countries are members of the club. They were cleared for entry because they cleared the Copenhagen criteria, and thus the EU feels a responsibility to do something in relation to the malaise in these countries, precisely because they're members of the club and there's a risk of contagion as well. Okay, so on to, within the limits of time, on to part two, which is who should regulate. Now, anyone who knows anything about the EU will know that almost nothing of this kind ever happens. No initiative of the kind that I've just put on the table from the Commission ever happens without there being a good intra-institutional fight within the EU about whether, between the institutions, about which institution should be in the driving seat in this respect. And this is exactly what happened, because basically it gets complicated. But in essence, what happened was this. Shortly after the 2014 Commission paper was put on the table, the Council Legal Service wrote a pretty damning assessment, simply saying, this is all very interesting, but really the Commission has no competence over this stuff at all. You know, they're simply saying, you, the Commission, have no competence to engage in these kind of regulatory initiatives. This is not based on Article 7. You're doing something independent of Article 7. Basic rules of competence of the EU, you can't do it. You have to ground your action in a specific treaty article. Fundamental rule about competence in the EU is that if any competence which does not go to the EU resides with the member states, so unless the EU can point to a specific ground of competence, then they can't do what they want to do. And the Council said, you're just inventing this out of the air, you don't have a competence. That argument was contested in the academic literature. It was argued, Leonard Besselink wrote a good piece on this, showing that, in fact, the assumption that the 2014 Commission paper could not be read into or regarded as part of the Article 7 procedure was inaccurate. In other words, what Besselink said is, look, this new commission procedure does not have to be perceived as something completely outside of Article 7. It can be regarded legitimately, without straining the words of Article 7, it can be regarded as an aspect of what is explicitly regulated within Article 7. Then what happened was that, and this again is—it's really, I mean, I'm summarising, but hopefully not too inaccurately. Basically, then what happened was that the council itself backed off. They didn't endorse their own legal service. I mean, they didn't run with this argument. Why not? Well, that's interesting, and it's a matter of speculation. But I think that the real reason they didn't run with it and they didn't push the council legal service advice is that from the perspective of the council, they were actually quite happy for the commission to be in the lead on these issues. In other words, the council would always have some say at the end of the day, but if you're thinking, who has to play bad cop the whole time, who has to play the tough guy in the front, well, you know, get the commission to do it. They can then take the heat, they can then take the flak that comes with it. And why would the council want to try and arrogate that power to itself? The council would know that if the power was arrogated to itself, it would face all sorts of internal tensions and conflicts of interest within the council about the actual application of that power. So better to leave somebody else in the front row, the commission, you do the investigation. Okay, so in effect, the way it moved forward was that the commission, we had this implicit acceptance that the commission's 2014 initiative could start moving forward. Okay, so I haven't got much time, so let me just say a word or two about the third issue, how to regulate. Okay. There are a whole series of points here, but let me just mention a few. There's been a debate in this area about whether you prioritise political or legal mechanisms for regulation in this area. My view on this on that is very straightforward. I don't think this is a zero-sum game. I don't think you have to say it has to be all political or all legal. So what would the legal mechanisms be? Well, you can make use of Article 258. 258 is the enforcement mechanism whereby the Commission sues a member state for violation of EU law. And it's not at all implausible or improbable or even particularly strained to contend that if a member state violates the rule of law in important respects, that can have implications, direct implications for the application of EU law within that country, which could then be used as the foundation for an action brought by the Commission against the member state. And indeed, Kim Lane Chappelle from Princeton has investigated this area in a really excellent paper as well, arguing, and I think correctly, that 258 can again legitimately be used, if you like, in aggregate. In other words, you can, within a 258 action, you can actually pull together, it's not just one individual violation, you can take, as it were, an aggregate of violations and use that as the basis for your action. So I think, so my first point is, I'm happy to have legal and political mechanisms of regulation. Secondly, briefly, there's been criticism of the 2014 initiative by the Commission, by academics, and that criticism, in effect, says Well, that the 2014 mechanism, which takes place in a sense ex ante before Article 7 is really triggered, is inappropriate. It's better for everything to be done formally within the confines of Article 7 for a variety of reasons. Now, once again, I actually don't agree with that. I mean, this argument was put forward by Dmitry Korchinov and Laurent Peck. They're both good academics. I respect them both, but I don't agree with this. It seems to me that the essence of what the Commission was doing in its 2014 paper was very sensible. It was basically saying, actually triggering Article 7 is a kind of pushing a nuclear button or something close thereto. You know, if you actually start formally triggering it. So what the, you know, what the 2014 Commission paper was doing was in effect saying, well, look, let's do our damnedest ahead of this to try and head off the problem at the pass. Let's try and give the state every possible opportunity to put its cards on the table so that we can understand the problems, try and deal with them, and thereby obviate the need for recourse to Article 7. And then only if you can't do that, should you have recourse to Article 7. That seems to me, politically and legally, a rather sensible strategy, because it means that the state can, you know, it becomes much more difficult for the recalcitrant state in those circumstances to say, well, I never had the opportunity to explain my position, I never had the opportunity to get across to you the kind of problems we're facing, etc. So that's the second issue. Very briefly, a third and fourth issue. There's been much talk about having new criteria, new ways of dealing with this in terms of how to regulate. And one of the new ideas, which is a perfectly sensible one, is what's called a sort of post-accession Copenhagen criteria. So this is the idea here is states have to comply with these Copenhagen criteria when they join. Once they join, at present, there's no continuing obligation of that same kind. So the idea is, well, let's make it a continuing obligation. Let's make compliance with the Copenhagen criteria a continuing obligation, not something which collapses once you become a member of the EU. Assuming, you know, that idea is then followed through, there'd be issues about how you test it, who tests it, okay? If that was followed through, that, you know, is it done in-house by the Commission? There was talk of actually using the Fundamental Rights Agency, also talk of using a body outside the EU, such as the Venice Commission, of which I happen to be a member. So all of that becomes an interesting issue as well. Fourth and finally, and then I'm going to stop because I've run out of time, fourth and final point is that, and I think maybe the most efficacious way of dealing with this, which is that interesting proposals have been put forward to link compliance with rule of law with money. Okay? I mean, putting it crudely, link it with money. In other words, states get all sorts of disbursements from the EU, financial disbursements either in real cash or in cash in kind, aid grants, the like. And the idea is it wouldn't be rocket science to have some direct causal linkage between compliance with the rule of law criteria and how much money you get from the system. Dennis, I've said enough. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much.